my story will never be complete.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
My name is Dana. I work here at Haymarket Books. I want to welcome everybody to our event tonight, Revolutionary Defeat and the Future of Struggle in Syria and Beyond. We have folks joining us in person here in Chicago. We also have folks joining us virtually, so welcome to everyone. For those of you who are not familiar with Haymarket House, which is the physical space that we're in here in Chicago, it is the home of Haymarket Books Publishing, but we also are a community event space, and we hope to be a space where people continue to gather in community in trying to build a better world. And especially now, that feels very important for us to come together in spaces like this and have conversations about how to make the world a better place. I also want to give a special thank you and shout out to the co-sponsors of this event, Northwestern University's Middle East and North African Studies program. So give them a round of applause. And New Lines Magazine. We also acknowledge that Haymarket House events take place on the occupied lands of the Council of the Three Fires, the Ojibwe, Ottawa, and Potawatomi, who are the indigenous keepers of this land, and they were forcibly removed for the founding of the city of Chicago. We stand in solidarity with their ongoing struggles for liberation today. We also want to acknowledge and stand in solidarity with the many families who are currently under siege right now in Gaza, as Israel continues to organize a full-scale invasion and has cut off water, food, and aid to those living in Gaza. So an acknowledgement of that as well. So for our program tonight, we are very, very honored to have Yasmin Alhaj Saleh, the author of The Impossible Revolution, here with us in person. We were actually talking about doing a book launch in 2018 for your book when it came out, when you were unable to join us in person. So this is really like book launch 5 years later, which is really amazing for those of us here at Haymarket to get to meet you in person and celebrate your work at a time when it's more relevant than ever. I will leave the introductions to the folks running the meeting, but I just want to say Yasmin is a leading intellectual voice of the Syrian uprising and one of the key thinkers in the Arab world today, which again is just very special for us to have him here in person. And Yasmin will be joined in conversation with Danny Postel from New Lines Magazine and Wendy Perlman, who is a professor of political science at Northwestern University and is the current director of the MENA Studies program. And Wendy's book is also available, as well as New Lines Magazine's, for those of you who are here with us in person. And I will turn it over to Danny and Wendy to get us started. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So on behalf of the Middle East and North Africa program at Northwestern, my name is Wendy Perlman. So I have the honor of beginning our long introduction to Yasmin Alhaj Saleh. So as was just said, Yasmin Alhaj Saleh is one of the leading intellectual voices of the Syrian revolution. He was arrested at the age of 19 for his membership in the Syrian Communist Party. Political Bureau, he spent 16 years in prison from 1980 to 1996. His wife, Samira Al-Khalil, was abducted by an armed group nearly 10 years ago and has been missing ever since. In addition to that personal story, Yassine, as a leading thinker, has authored 9 books, including The Impossible Revolution, Making Sense of the Syrian Tragedy, over there for sale, and a book that is has its English translation currently in the works, The Atrocious and Its Representation. One of the founders of the Arabic-English platform Al-Jumhuriyya, he writes for a variety of international publications and is also a contributing writer for New Lines magazine.
Thanks, Wendy. On behalf of New Lines magazine, I want to thank Haymarket Books and its amazing team. Thank you, Dana, Rory, and John, and the entire Haymarket crew, not only for all of the work they've done to make this event possible tonight, but also for taking on Yassine Hajzadeh's book, The Impossible Revolution. As Wendy mentioned, Haymarket was the U.S. publisher of the English translation of this book, which was Yassine's first book in English. Yassine has written multiple books in Arabic, and they've been translated into many languages all over the world. But The Impossible Revolution was the very first book of Yassine's to be translated into English and published in the U.S. by Haymarket Books. And as Dana mentioned, we actually held an event sort of in absentia in 2018 when the book came out. We couldn't have Yassine here in the U.S. He wasn't able to join us, but we had a panel discussion about the book and talked about Yassine in his absence. And now, tonight, I remember at the end of that event, I think we said, one day, inshallah, we will have Yassine present in the flesh, and we will raise a glass with him, and we will be able to, he will be able to talk back and tell us everything we got wrong that night. But no, in all seriousness, it is just such a dream come true to have Yassine sitting here in Haymarket House in Chicago, which is the first city on this multi-city speaking tour that he's doing. He'll be going to Washington, D.C., and Montreal, and Boston, and New York, but Chicago first. This is his first public-facing event in the United States on this book tour. So it's such a thrill. And I want to thank the MENA program at Northwestern for making this event possible in partnership with Haymarket Books and New Lines magazine. I spent several years of my professional life at the MENA program at Northwestern, so I have a very personal relationship with it and with my good friend Wendy Perlman. So, one last word about New Lines magazine. Unlike the books which you will have to pay for, you can just grab copies of New Lines magazine. They are for free. The first 4 print issues, many of you know that New Lines is principally an online publication. It started 3 years ago as an online-only magazine. But about a year ago, we went back to the future and we went in reverse. Most publications started in print and created a website at some point, in many cases discontinued their print operation. We did the opposite. We started as an online magazine, and then 2 years into it, decided to launch a print publication. We now have 4 copies. It's a quarterly, so it's been on for a year, and you're welcome to copies. The very first issue we published a year ago contains a beautiful essay by none other than Yassine himself. Now, there's a line from a beautiful little essay by a scholar I don't know personally, Fadi Nasser, of the Lebanese American University in Beirut. He writes, "Not since Edward Said has an intellectual from the Middle East helped the world see itself by looking at the region. Yassine Hajzadeh bears witness to the dysfunctions of our world, the cruelty of its exclusions, and the unraveling of solidarities in the face of existential doom. He asks us to look at Syria, its pain, its struggle, its trauma, its people, and their fundamental right to dignity and freedom. He forces us to grapple with the failure of our global solidarities. His words and his defiant life give hope in a world of such monstrous despair. A hope grounded not in romantic ideologies or empty slogans, but in a genuine appreciation for the extraordinary power of ordinary people and their fight for nothing short of their collective freedom.
Thank you, Danny. Okay, the first question. So Yassine, when we were deciding on the theme for this event, you said, let's begin with a defeat. What does defeat mean to you, and why do you want to start there?
First of all, thank you for Haymarket Books, for Danny and Wendy, my very dear friends, and for you to show up. Well, we lost the battle for owning our country. Syrians has been living under the same family rule for more than, I mean, when the revolution started, it was more than 40 years. Now it is 53 years, which is quite a long time. Most of my life, for instance, most of, well, not Syrians, but most of the age, some of them, most of you actually were born after. So we felt like exiled in our own country. So the uprising was, the Syrian revolution was about owning the country. It was like colonizing, like colonizing, actually, whatever. And some of my work I talked about, so the uprising was about this, about owning the country, or owning politics in the country, because, I mean, we were denied citizenship rights. For one, I was deprived of my civil rights for 15 years after my 16 years in jail. So up to the uprising, I was without civil rights. But honestly, none, a single Syrian has civil rights. So I didn't feel when I was in the country denied the rights, because everybody was without rights. So owning politics meant in the Syrian context two things: to speak for yourself, or to talk about public issues, and to gather with other people. We have a short experience of trying to own politics. It's called the last spring in 2001, and it was the main thing about the last spring was forums, or forums, the plural was forum. Well, gatherings of people in dozens or in few hundreds talking about politics in a bit critical way. So this is because Syrians before the last spring and before the revolution were denied expressing themselves and talking about their grievances, their demands, their aspirations. And they were prevented even more harshly from gathering, from meeting, from organization. So the last spring was a short experience of this trying to own politics. We Syrians were living under poverty line, under political poverty line. 100% of Syrians were under, even those who were supporters of the regime, right? I mean, they were not allowed to organize or to talk freely. So when the revolution came, it was about this. It was about challenging this this long experience of being dealt, of being denied the right to speech and the right to gather. And the rallies, first phase of the revolution, peaceful, it was people, gatherings of people from dozens to hundreds of thousands in Hama, for instance, in August, in July, August 2011. And they were talking, or chanting, or expressing their political demands. This failed. We've been crushed. The revolution is defeated in the meaning that the aspiration to reclaim the country and to own politics, to be citizens, to be citizens, to talk to speak for ourselves and to organize this has been crushed. And with huge losses, I mean, you know, at least half a million people were covered. People are still being covered, by the way. Now, in Gaza, it's bombed by the Israelis, the regime is with the Russians and the Iranians are bombing Idlib. And 7 million displaced outside the country, which is around 30% of the population. It's a huge thing. And the country is divided into four Syrians, at least. But to mention Golan Heights, which has been occupied by Israel for 56 years now, a bit more than 56 years. So it's a huge thing. It is, and we have five occupation powers, Iran, the US, Russia, Turkey, and before all Israel. So it is a situation that we don't know many examples of. And this meaning, yeah, there's a big defeat, but also a big something unprecedented on the global level, in my opinion. And maybe Syria is not important to many people. It is important for us, Syria, because it's our country, it's the only country that we have. Well, now we have 127 countries, actually, according to a report by Human Rights Watch, only to 22. Syrians were scattered in 127 countries. Maybe we have conquered more countries in the last 2 years. So, but Syria became important because much of the world is in Syria, and a big percent of Syrians are in the world, everywhere. So in this meaning, Syria is a microcosm, and it is important to people everywhere, those who are interested in a different future of humanity. It is because it's a microcosm, and because in a different way, the world is becoming, maybe we will talk about this later, is progressively Syrianized.
Yassine, I mean, there's a lot more to be said about this question of defeat, by the way, and I hope that we will get into it in the Q&A. This is just to open the topic. But in a recent essay for New Lines magazine on what you call liquid imperialism, which is your a coinage that you've come up with with reference to the late Polish sociologist Zygmunt Bauman. But in that essay, you detail the confluence of multiple factors that short-circuited the Syrian democratic struggle. Regional and global powers, which you just referred to, the United States, Russia, and then regionally, Iran, Turkey, Israel. Another factor is what you call the internal colonialism of the Assad regime. And then thirdly, there were the Salafi jihadists, who you have this interesting term for them, you call them the conquered imperialists. So let's take these on one at a time. You've already touched on the regional and global powers. What do you mean by the internal colonialism of the Assad regime?
Yeah. Actually, because it is the country has been ruled. Look, the Ba'ath Party seized power in Syria in March 1963. So it is 60 years and half. From the very first moment, there was a state of exception. And Syria lived under this state exception that was legitimized by our war, by the war against Israel, the national enemy. In 2012, the legitimizing ideology turned to the war on terror. So there's a continuous war, actually. But it was against the enemy, the national enemy. Now it is against those who oppose the regime. And this state of exception is one of the, it is one of the essential characteristics of colonialism. Colonial powers don't rule by law; they rule by directives and by commands given to. Security apparatus and all these things. Then there's the very brutal way of dealing with the people. like the colonial powers, there is the white undo, the regime, the Assad regime, especially is expert at dividing the population and instilling fear among them and frightening some sections of the society. Frightening them. Other sections are against you or they will target you, especially Syria as a society with many religions and confessional community. So there is also this thing that characterizes the colonial, the French colonial rule in Syria after the First World War, after the First World War to the end of the Second World War. So it's the same, actually. Then there's this destruction of political life, of political plurality in the country. I mean, the regime shows the Syrian society a sovereign face, that all the society should be an army. It is an internal front. While it deals with the external world in politics, and finding political solutions. So it is like also colonial power on this, from this side. So this is about the internal colonies. Syria has been colonized by a family rule that divided Syrians, that dealt with them very brutally, and that resort to political solutions with external powers. The only commitment that the Assad regime kept so faithfully is the relation with Israel. The Golan Heights front have been the calmest, more than Sina, more than the relation between Egypt and Israel, and more than Jordan front, which is also there's political relation. Far calmer and with extremely controlled by the regime. So, if you, and now about the conquered imperialists, it is, I call the Islamists, especially the Salafi jihadists, conquered imperialists, because on one level their imaginary is obsessed by the ghosts of our old empires, the Muslim old empires. At the same time, they are conquered, they are weak, they are. So their problem with the American imperialism or the Russians or is that there is no emancipatory dimension in it. It is that we should rule, we are the sovereign. So it is not about about liberation, it is not about freedom. In this meaning, I call them conquered imperialists. Actually, it is a title of a book published in 2019. And in Syria, actually, they were extremely destructive. Daesh. So Syria is a showcase of imperialism, represented by the US and Russia, sub-imperial powers, regional powers, Israel, Iran, and Turkey, a colonial power, internal colonialism, represented by the Assad family, and conquered imperialism, represented by Salafi jihadi. So also in this, from this perspective, it is a unique situation.
Wow. So I'm thinking about all of those different types of imperialisms or forces that short-circuited the Syrian revolution, makes us think of the title of your book, The Impossible Revolution. So what did you mean by impossible? In what sense was it impossible? Because it was doomed from the start? Could it have taken a different route? Was it impossible because it was unthinkable to ever happen in the first place? Or are there maybe many different meanings to the term impossible?
Well, actually, I meant that it was unimaginable, as you just said, but it happened. So it was. If you ask me a bit before the revolution, that will there be a revolution in Syria, I would, maybe my answer would have been to looks. And I guess someone serious would show hesitancy about it. But it happened. So it was impossible to imagine, but it really happened. But then I had the idea hopefully some interesting term, the destruction of revolution is impossible. I mean, I gave some idea about it with these 5 hours with the concurrent analysis, with the huge losses, with the unprecedented human suffering, displacement of 7 million Syrians. It was unimaginable, impossible. It seemed impossible to me that no one imagined that it can take these dimensions in Syria. Early 2012, I wrote an article, a short article, saying what can the regime do more than what had, it had done up to that time. It was almost a year after the uprising. Would they attack cities and neighborhood by war planes? And it happened just 2 or 3 months later. It happened, it started happening in July 2012. And the battle bombs were not invented at that time. It also took 2 or 3 months for the battle bombs. But then what I built on this is that now that the revolution was impossible, and the destruction of the revolution and the Syrian society have been impossible, the solution in Syria should be impossible in a way. I mean, it is a farce to, with this huge tragedy, to think that the Constitutional Committee or the meetings in Astana or where, this is a political solution. This is very insulting to our struggle. A huge tragedy with these very farcical, cheating, despicable, good words for it. So it should be impossible. Impossible does not mean that it cannot happen. It is just that the foreign powers should leave, the refugees should go back, there should be meaningful, substantial political change. These are impossible. If we are serious, if we want to have real peace and real future for the country, this should happen. That the Syrians own their country, as I said, my answer for the first question. It is all about owning Syria. Syrians owning their country, reclaiming their country as citizens. So this is impossible. Why we have 5 occupation powers, why the same regime is still in power, which is the most tragic and the most, the worst future of our struggle, and that the refugees would go back if they want, of course. So many of them want, if they would be safe. 1 million in Lebanon, almost 1 million in Jordan, 3.5 million in Turkey, many hundreds of thousands in Europe. I guess so many of them would like to go back.
You see, you've noted that there are 3 dominant discourses about Syria and the Middle East more generally in the world. The first you call geopolitical. The second you call culturalist or civilizationist. And the third you say might be called top-down anti-imperialist. That's a very interesting phrase, top-down anti-imperialist. So, but you say that what these discourses, for whatever differences they might have, what they have in common is that they deny the agency of Syrians struggling for democracy and social justice. So maybe instead of going through each of them, although in the Q&A perhaps people can ask about the geopolitical, the civilizationist, I'd like to focus for purposes of this discussion on this category that you call top-down anti-imperialist. What exactly do you mean by that, and how does this top-down anti-imperialism deny Syrian agency?
Allow me still to say something about geopolitical civilization. So the discourse of governments in the mainstream in the West is a geopolitical. So it is about capitals, and about presidents, about foreign ministries, about armies. So Damascus, Riyadh, Cairo, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, whatever. And the presidents are these MBS and these people. This is a geopolitical thing. And wars, of course. Wars are, they are terrible. And born and Jews. That civilization talk all the time about Islam and Sunnah, Shia, and so the population are defined by their supposed religious beliefs. And with a primordial approach to these beliefs. So the Sunnis are like this, the Shia are like this, the Alawites are like this. So and they have been all the time. Obama said, and in the book that you edited with Nader Hashimi, that, well, it is, what can we do? It is Sunnah and Shia killing each other for thousands of years. Thousands of years. Well, very peaceful thing, actually. Very, very lazy and very. From the cerebral president of the US. So, I was not thinking before the uprising that there are many of our leftist comrades, they have a discourse about it. Actually, it was not there. Before the uprising, it was not there. And one of my shocking experiences that after the uprising, that many leftists were against the Syrian uprising, I thought that these were our comrades, and of course they would support our struggle. They know, and it was, or at least it was easy to know that many communists fought against the regime for democracy, for justice. And so it was a really shocking thing. And I started to see this top down imperialism, these comrades, these big comrades, have their own grand schematic analysis about the world. It is one big fight against American Indians. And all the other struggles are annexed. So there's no autonomy of other struggles. There's no autonomy of Syrians struggling in Syria, of Iraqis in Iraq, Egyptians. It's three Syrians actually, because in Egypt and Tunisia and other countries, they were perceived to be closer to the American imperialism. So the struggle against American imperialism is also, or they were against Mubarak regime or against the Abedin Tunisia, because they were perceived to be close to them. In Syria, it was quite different. So our struggle is accepted only if it can be it can relate itself to this grand battle against American imperialism that I, to be honest, I don't see our grand comrades doing anything. They are quite safe here. They learn them better than the best universities in the world. They are okay very well. And they were all the time reprimanding us and blaming us for not being good fighters, activists against imperialism. So it was really a shameful page of the history of the left. It is top down imperialism because they don't see how people were fighting for their life. The real struggle against imperialism is against internal poverty in Syria, against the occupation's powers in Syria, Palestine, here and there. Those are the people who are fighting imperialism and for democracy and for rights and for equality. Not those who are in New York or in MIT or in Chicago or something. Who are just telling people all the time how to fight or how to understand the world and how to be a real leftist. there are many examples. I don't want volunteers to give any now. But yeah, so this is what I mean.
Just a quick follow-up on that. So what you're calling this top-down anti-imperialism, it's also a very selective form of anti-imperialism because it focuses in a very myopic way on one specific instance of imperialism or form of imperialism, which is U.S. imperialism, and to the exclusion of other imperialisms, Russian imperialism, Iranian imperialism, or the internal colonialism of the Assad regime. And in so doing, wouldn't you say that this kind of U.S.-centric worldview is its own kind of colonialism?
Yeah, this is what I said, actually. Now we have to mention one name. But this is what I said in Long Essay, New Lines magazine. It was a critic of Noam Chomsky, who's a great thinker and a great activist, one of the great names in the world of the left and the linguistics in so many fields. So, yeah, it is, American imperialism is really extremely destructive in the Middle East, especially in the Middle East. And we are seeing that now, something in Palestine with extreme. The US has been an extremist and nationalist power in the Middle East all the time. So, when I criticize this myopic approach, it is not to say that American imperialism is not very bad, but to say there are other imperialists, the ones who are targeting Israel and killing civilians and who have targeted hospitals dozens of times. One yesterday, Israel, or was it today? After today, they targeted the hospital and they killed hundreds of people. And see, it has been happening for years by the Russians. Not to mention the sub-imperial powers of Iran and Turkey. So, and of course, Israel before all. So it is just to develop a more complex, more multi-dimensions analysis of imperialism. And imperialism is not a sense that we go to the White House or to the Pentagon and fight it somewhere. Yeah, a certain office. It is a relation, a power relation, and when you have occupation powers, these are within this colonial relation. I try to analyze this. ANSI is a great example to understand this power relation, this colonial imperialist power relation.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism, Debates in the Second International, 1900 to 1910, edited by Mike Tabor. At its height, from 1889 to 1914, the Second Socialist International represented the majority of organized workers in the world, with the revolutionary goal of overthrowing capitalism. Its major accomplishments, such as the 8-hour day and International Women's Day, testify to its lasting influence around the world. In this important collection of debates at Congresses of the Second International, Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism captures the International's vibrancy and gives a snapshot of its strengths, weaknesses, and contradictions. As David McNally puts it, this book is a treasure chest for every socialist seeking to understand the history of their movement. Bringing together documents from 1900 to 1910, Mike Tabor shows us how socialists more than a century ago analyzed and debated key questions of their time. Find Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism at haymarketbooks.org.
You mentioned Palestine. What have you been thinking these past 11 days while watching these latest events in Palestine and the world, Israel and Gaza, and especially maybe as a participant in the Syrian revolution? What, as a human and as a Syrian, what have you been your thoughts and your feelings watching this?
For a week, I came to the U.S. a week after. The timing couldn't have been worse in a way and better in another way. I came as a Syrian activist, as a writer, it was planned to talk about Syria mostly. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you cannot say a word about Syria without saying something or many things about Palestine. In the Middle East, we have Israel as a paradigm of Palestine, of political annihilation. Palestinians have been politicized by Israel for 75 years, denied any political autonomy. So this paradigm is the one we have in Syria. So we Syrians have been Palestinized for almost, I mean, less than Palestinian people, but for almost 60 years without political rights, without political, without autonomy, without, yeah, this was, this is what I was, yeah, I refer to as internal colonialism. At the same time, the regime is Israelized, so the paradigm is there. I don't mean that to say that, yeah, they are very, to build false between them. But I think the paradigm is the same. And we are, in a way, Palestinians. That's why, of course, there are other ideological and emotional elements we, as Syrians, I guess, Arabs, identify easily with the Palestine. We talk the same language, we have the same cuisine, we have almost the same songs and the cultural traditions, so it is, yeah, we feel that we are the same. And besides, there were 600,000 Palestinian refugees in Syria before the uprising, and they were crushed by us, actually. Many Palestinians who joined the uprising, I guess there were thousands of martyrs among the Palestinians, the Syrian Palestinians, and they are now scattered for the third or fourth time, like so many Syrians. So, and that's meaning I feel that I feel like I am a Palestinian. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and besides that, as a writer, I wrote much about this stuff here and there. And so it is one struggle with different rhythms, different intensities, yeah, different battles. But in essence, it is the same. It is about freedom, it is about justice, it is about independence, it is about owning, again, owning your country.
Yeah. Yassine, one of the effects of the last 10 days has been, it seems to me, a kind of return of a certain rhetoric, the paradigm of the axis of resistance, which I think it's fair to say have been, for the last several years, somewhat exposed as moribund, as empty, as a kind of fiction, really, by the Syrian uprising, and then, of course, by the uprisings in 2019 in both Lebanon and especially Iraq, where you had, you know, these so-called resistance powers, Iran, Hezbollah in particular, took the side not of the Syrian protesters, but the regime that was crushing and annihilating them. And in Lebanon, in October 2019, the streets are full of protesters demonstrating, calling for an end to this awful status quo and ruling regime, and Hezbollah sides not with the protesters, but in fact with the regime of which it is a part, and Iran is on that same side. And then in Iraq, it's even bloodier because the Iranian regime is directly involved in actually mass violence and repression against protesters in Iraq. So the point being that this axis of resistance paradigm was exposed as being really nonsensical. It was what I think the late Ulrich Beck would have called a zombie category. That is to say, a category that may have made sense of certain circumstances in the world at some point, but stopped making sense of changing circumstances. And yet the concept goes on living. It's dead, but it goes on living as if it were alive. But now, in the last 10 days, it seems that the rhetoric has shifted again. And you have this, led the language of the axis of resistance. Iran is on the side of Hamas and on the side of resisting what's happening in Israel. So my question to you is essentially, I mean, how do you make sense of this as someone who, you know, has experienced, in a sense, the fiction of the axis of resistance firsthand? Where are we? What does this mean that the language of the axis of resistance seems to be back from the dead all of a sudden?
But for long decades, the Syrian regime uses this rhetoric of resistance, of caring about Palestinian cause, and while was arresting, torturing, and killing Syrians and Palestinians who opposed the regime. So it is sort of instrumentalization of the Palestinian cause because it is really dear to the people. It is important to the people, to the Syrian people, to the people, to the Arabs, non-Arabs in the Middle East. So Iran is doing the same thing. It is instrumentalizing the Palestinian cause to expand its influence in Iraq, in Syria, and in Lebanon. And these three countries are now within the dominion of the Iranian regime. I don't see any liberatory dimension in this. The Iranians are responsible of killing and of the destruction of Syria. They were against, systematically and principally, they were against any political solution in Syria. They never, ever expressed their respect for the Syrian demands for freedom, for justice, for a better political life. And they are doing it in Iran. So how you cannot crush your people while you now a growing percentage of the Iran population are against the Palestinian cause because it has been used by the Islamic Republic to justify crushing the Lamas revolution, for instance, and all the protests in Iran before this. Qasem Soleimani literally walked on the blood of our brothers in Aleppo before he was killed. I know that he's considered, unfortunately, this is a bloody mistake, that he's considered sort of a revolutionary by some sectors of the left in the West. This is really shameful. He is responsible. He's like a colonial commander moving in the colonies of the Iran Empire. They're sort of an empire, Iran has always imperialist aspirations, and now it is there. The American occupation of Iraq actually was great for Iran more than any. But you know, so the Americans are still there, but Iran is the real dominating power in Iraq. And Syria is the same, and Lebanon even more so. Hezbollah is, they openly say that they are part of Wilayat al-Faqih, which means the name, sort of a religious technical name for the Iranian religious Islam group. So, you give an example of Lebanon. Hezbollah was not only against the uprising in Lebanon, they attacked the protesters themselves. And Hassan Nasrallah himself said, you cannot change the regime. He was not analyzing the struggle, of course. He meant that will not allow him to challenge it and to change it. So it is just instrumentalizing the Palestinian cause for domination, and with a sectarian dimension. Iran is dividing the region, and there has been so many genocidal massacres in Iraq and Syria because of this pushing, dividing societies and It's kind of amazing, these struggles. They have happened, it's been happening in Syria for more than 12 years now.
So let's turn from the geopolitical to something more personal. So you've said that the two most formative experiences in your life have been your 16 years in prison and the abduction of Samira. Can you tell us, I guess, a bit about the significance of both or either of these events, and really especially how the ongoing nightmare of Samira's disappearance affects you today?
Because they are for better experiences in the beginning, and then they change. My long years in jail, when I was quite young, quite an intense experience, very long, with torture. All my 20s and more than half of my 30s in jail, and there are no spare parts for your 20s. They wouldn't know. They are gone. So I was 36 when I was released. It is an experience that changed one. And I will change it actually. And in a way, it was an emancipatory experience. I was young, I was healthy. Most of it, I was able to read and to learn. It was in this meaning a formative experience. Since that's what it is, even more intense experience, it is more painful, and it's associated with feeling and guilt, of course. I couldn't do anything to help my missing wife, so it is something that I've been living with for almost 10 years. December 9th, it will be 10 years. So it is also a changing experience, actually. It came when one looks for peace in his life. So from these two experiences, I have two defining struggles. A struggle against a tyranny that destroyed the lives of millions of Syrians in my generations. In my generation, hundreds of thousands of people were affected directly. Now it is in millions. Actually, every single Syrian has been affected in this way of struggle. And the other one is against fundamentalism, or what I call it, the Zionist Islamists. So I have defined struggle and the meaning of the for my identity. Who I am, I can define myself with these two struggles. I have a third struggle, maybe not defining in the same intense way, which is struggle against colonialism. Five colonial powers that I mentioned. But maybe this is not defining in the same way. It is not to say anything positive about colonial powers, but they didn't put me in jail and torture me, and they didn't take my. It is not only my wife, by the way, it is my brother as well, and my friends, many of my friends. So, this meaning, these are visceral struggles that I live with. In my writings, I write much about these. A rather personal way, kindness, but more
stuff. These are struggles that are part of your identity. There are other struggles you might have commitments with, but these define your very self. So something else that maybe is part of your identity and self now is exile. So you've lived in exile for the last decade, first in Istanbul, now in Berlin. As an intellectual, how do you think about exile, conceptualize or theorize exile? And as a person, how has it affected you in your perspective on the Syrian struggle?
I always think of exile in relation to Jacob. Mm-hmm. Actually, I have a small book. It's not. It is at the same fellow in English, by the way. It is Freedom, Home, Jail, Exile, and the War. It is a fellow in German and Italian book for booklet for. So, in jail, you are in certain space, not allowed to go out. Exile, you are in a certain space, you are not allowed to go back. So you are imprisoned outside, in a way. So I see it's sort of a continuation. And there's also a reference to the defining strengths. One of them, the idea that I got, and I have a book about jail, and this book is about freedom, actually. I mean, even writing about jail is writing about freedom. Mm-hmm. And writing about exile is, in a way, writing about home and home. So for me, now, exile is a continuation of jail in a different way, and at the same time, it changes the perception of hope. I was not able to write about my years in jail itself. I am unable now to write about exile and exile. For me, home is the place, is the only place in which I can write about exile. So I need Syria for this. Home is the place that in which I can write about exile, or in which the story can be complete. My story will never be complete unless the only place for this story to be complete is Syria. No, I wasn't happy, I am now living in Germany, so there are 200 countries in the world. None of these 200 countries is the right place to complete the story. It is only one tragic country, or terrible country, Syria. So, yeah, I mean, you see that Zaire is changing my perception of home, of my world. Well, of course, I don't much. I am moving in the world now. I have never had a passport before 2018, and I guess this was the reason why I didn't come.
Yeah,
I don't remember really what's the reason, but I did have a passport before the end of 2018 for the first time in my life. So I am moving there, and I don't have personal reasons to complain. Yeah. I'm okay. But I don't have any personal thing remaining. Everything is public, everything is political, everything is, I don't like this because it denies you privacy, but it is what it is, and I don't know to complain.
I want our friends in the audience here tonight at Haymarket House to get your questions ready because we are transitioning to the audience Q&A very soon. But before we do, did you want to say something, Wendy?
No, except do you want to take a break before we move to the Q&A?
No.
Okay.
Okay, good, yeah.
Because we're really putting you through the ringer. It's quite a miracle.
We don't get you here that often, Missy. We're putting you to work.
Yeah.
So, Berlin, this flows directly from what Wendy was asking you about in terms of exile. I saw you in Berlin in 2019, and you took me to an extraordinary event, cultural event, in the Syrian community, and introduced me to this amazing range of Syrian activists, writers, filmmakers, people working in different NGOs and social service agencies, young people. It was just kind of a dizzying experience. And at the end of the night, I asked you, as we were saying goodnight, I said, you know, how are these Syrians in Berlin specifically, but more generally in exile, how are Syrians processing the defeat And my assumption was that this must be a particularly dark moment, because in 2019, it's really the end, this realization, there is no more armed struggle, the Assad regime is going to stay in power, it's over. And you said something counterintuitive that really struck me and stayed with me. You said, actually, this defeat is liberating because it opens the door for the next phase, for people to move on to what's next. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, and still wonder, what did you mean by that?
I don't remember. I guess it was about the moment of 2011 was behind us, and it should, we should move forward. So we were defeated, we lost. The battle that started in March 2011. I don't want to, I guess I didn't want to be nostalgic. That we know, and the circle is continuing, it's continuing, by the way, it is continuing, but you need rapture. You need, we defeated this round of struggle. We were knocked out, but we were continuing our struggle with different needs, the people you mentioned, the activists, writers, artists, continuing struggle in different ways. Actually, even in Syria, now there's an uprising in Sweden that has been going for a month and a half, and very revives the hopes of change. I don't know, change in Syria, most probably. Sweden is a small government in Syria, a few hundred thousands, so it is. But it, in a way, it reminds people that our story is still there. Our cause is still there. And the meanings, and the slogans, and the aims, and everything is still there. And it reminds one of the early period of the Syrian revolution. It was very beautiful, with rallies, with peaceful rallies, with songs with artistic dimension of protest. So it is happening again. But in exile, so many people are in a way achieving their own revolutions. And I see this as a continuation of the revolution in different ways, especially the younger generation, and especially maybe a bit more women. I guess my impression is that so many are owning their lives. So we wanted to own our country and we lost, so many growing number of people, especially women, are owning their lives in a more liberated and more, productive, creative. So this is what I meant. Honestly, I don't remember.
It was late at night, you shouldn't be held responsible for these statements.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe we'll have our last question then, is to end with a vision for action. What is your message for progressives and social justice activists, like the kind of people who show up to a Haymarket event? What do you want comrades here in the United States and elsewhere to know or to do?
I guess you know Ala Abdel Fattah, the Egyptian activist who's been in jail for almost 10 years now, on and off, mostly in and on and off, right? Yeah, mostly in jail, but he was half released for a short period, 2020, I guess. Ala has a book, it's available in English, You Have Not Been Defeated Yet.
I believe it's published by Haymarket.
It's not.
No, don't worry about it. I just assumed that all great books are published by Haymarket, sorry.
So, that's a good question. Ala said to, it was a conference somewhere in Europe, I guess, and he said, defend your democracy. So, the answer is defend your democracy, because democracy is a crisis everywhere in the world. democracy and social justice and freedom and the rule of law is endangered everywhere, I guess, in the US, like, of course, not like in Syria, but this is a crisis everywhere. And this blind support of a fascist regime in Israel is another proof that there's something extremely wrong. So the main thing is that to defend democracy, what I find, I'm really scared the developments of the last 10 years, not only because of the huge human suffering and misery that we are seeing, but because we no longer have any viable alternative. We don't have an ideal. We no longer have an ideal. Democracy is in crisis everywhere. And so we have a button. We have to revive the ideal of justice. I would say of socialism and away, because I don't mean the concept of communist socialism. I mean the presence of those who are absent. In the US, I guess, people of color, women, and since Adam, classic Adam, women, slaves, foreigners were relegated to inferior status. It is almost the same in modern democracies. The working class, women, people of color, immigrants, refugees are related to invisibility or to secondary status. So, socialism, I mean by socialism, the presence of those who are absent, those. The working, the communism, what was good about communism is that it was the presence of the working class. It was the way the working class broke through the stage of politics and national politics. So, in this meaning, I feel that the presence of those who are absent, and this included, by the way, the biosphere. The environment of the planet. So, because it is absent even more than slavers. And, so, yeah, and this meaning socialism can rejuvenate democracy. And I guess these are fields of struggle, very, very important, very vital, and very. They are now, they are our struggles now. At times, the people here, I'm not sure, the US, but you hear people in the West saying that, they don't have causes to struggle for. Unlike Edward Said said something similar, that one of his friends envied him that Edward Said had a cause and he was fighting and his colleague. Yeah, he felt sorry that he didn't have a cause. I think, well, this was never my idea. Yeah, you can fight. There's so many issues to fight for. There are so many causes, and yeah. So my message is, we have so many to fight for, and we have to fight.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.